So as the snow falls at the Granley Bakken Resort just outside Tahu City, we're at the Keystone Symposium on new insights into health span diseases of aging, from molecular to functional senescence. And we're talking to Mike. Now I can pronounce this either Bonkowski or Bonkowski. I assume that means that you're somewhere in the distant past, there's Polish background.
Yes, very much so.
Right, because one of my great heroes, of course, was somebody who did a television series called The Ascent of Man and was also the deputy director of the Salk Institute, one Jacob Bronowski. Who was, whenever I came over here and talked about him, people would say, "You mean Bronowski?" So, what interests me here is in listening to the talks from Angie Bartke and also from Lenny Guarenti, you are an intermediary in a sense between them, because you started the work that we're going to talk about. You started in Angie's lab, and then you're now at MIT in Lenny's lab, right?
So, yes.
And we're talking about calorie restriction here, but we're a whole panoply of things. Maybe you could just set the picture. Were you a graduate student at the time in Angie's lab?
Is that so? I originally started as a Angie's lab manager, and when he had moved to Southern Illinois University, he took me on as lab manager, and then we started my graduate program then in pharmacology. So it was at that point where I was in a transition, because at that point I was already a reproductive researcher, and that's what Andre was best known for. Yeah. So then as he had made the discovery that this small mouse that was reproductively infertile had this robust increase in lifespan from a single gene mutation, I had realized how important that work was. Because up to that point, evolutionary biologists were essentially saying, listen, you can't really have one mutation that will significantly affect lifespan. Now, just prior to that, Cynthia Kenyon had shown in C. elegans that a single mutation can robustly increase lifespan. But there was no mammalian evidence for this. And when I realized that my mentor, Andre Bartke, had the mouse that had the single gene mutation and that he had discovered this, I realized, wow, this is really, really important.
So what year are we in now?
So this would be probably in the vicinity of, say, like 2004.
Right.
2004, 2005. So at this time, I realized, wow, here we have this really long-lived mouse, and we have a couple different mutations. We had found originally, or Andre had found originally, that the Ames dwarf mouse was long-lived. And then this was followed up with a Snell dwarf mouse that Flerke and Miller had shown also had an extended life.
Again, just so that we've got the context for people, when we're talking, can you give me a little bit of background when we're talking about these different brands of mouse?
So the names come from whether where it's located or the researcher that found it. But essentially, the Ames dwarf mouse has a mutation in a pituitary transcription factor, which leads to a robust decrease in its normal hormonal signaling profile. And this reduction in its hormonal signaling profile decreased its reproductive axis. So its fecundity, or its ability to properly have a healthy sex life, was majorly reduced. So when that was the Ames, the Snell dwarf has another transcription factor mutation that leads to the same phenotype, or essentially the same phenotype, of reduced reproduction and an increase in lifespan. So those are those two models that I was discussing. But
so let me throw in, as we're going along on this trajectory, it'll all come clear at the end as we wrap it all together.
Hopefully.
But let me throw in a commentary from News and Views and a paper from Linda Partridge's lab. This is from Nature, the last issue of last year, 2009. And this is the diet and longevity in the balance piece. And I'll just read the line because this fits into what you're talking about. Dietary restriction promotes longevity but impairs fecundity in many organisms. When the amino acids in a diet are fine-tuned, however, lifespan can be increased without loss of fecundity, at least in fruit flies. So we're talking about this whole story here of when you tend to do calorie restriction and increase lifespan, the downside may well be that you decrease fecundity and so on. So this is all in the same neck of the woods, essentially, right?
Well, at that time, it wasn't clear.
Right.
So at that time, now it seems to be more and more clear. But at that time, it wasn't. And when the mouse was originally discovered, it was my understanding that people assumed it may be a calorie restriction-like mimetic and that the animal was the same. But there was no evidence that could actually provide that link. And when I was in Andre's lab, right before I had joined the lab, they had put that Ames dwarf mouse with that pituitary transcription factor on calorie restriction. And what they found was it did further benefit its life. So at that point, it was understood that these mutations that made this smaller mouse that extended its life was not the same as calorie restriction. That's when I decided that maybe the mutations that affect the pituitary was too pleiotropic, or it affected too many hormone axes at once. So in other words, maybe it's not just like calorie restriction because they received a further benefit in their lifespan. So we had another model, which was a growth hormone receptor knockout mouse. And this mouse was developed by John Kopchick at University of Ohio. And this mouse had one specific hormonal signaling deficiency, and that was the receptor for growth hormone, which comes from the pituitary, actually was not there. It was deleted. And this meant that this was, maybe you could say, a cleaner model, because there was specifically one axis affected robustly, rather than all the hormone axes being affected. So I put this animal on a long-term calorie restriction study to see if it would live even longer on CR. And when I started the study, that's what I thought would happen. And I remember about a year and a half into the study, I had started to put the data into the computer, and I had saw that there was no benefit in life extension in this growth hormone receptor knockout mouse. And I wanted to cry. I had thought to myself, I have just worked 2 years straight, and I am not seeing my experiment work. Something's wrong. And I went home. I think I didn't go back to the lab for a couple days. I was embarrassed. I didn't want to talk about it. And I then began to realize, but wait, my control mice are receiving a benefit, a clear, robust benefit in life extension from CR. And those are the wild type litter mates, or the animals that were born with the knockouts but don't have the mutation or don't have the deletion of the growth hormone receptor. So they were a perfect control, and they were receiving a benefit in life extension. So this meant my CR regimen, or the work that I was doing, was proper because my controls showed a benefit. But the long-lived growth hormone receptor knockout mice did not. And that's when I realized maybe there is a significant overlap between the hormone signaling pathways, these trade-offs between reproduction and growth, and CR.
Calorie restriction.
Calorie restriction, yes.
These are pituitary knockout mice, right?
So currently that's in Lenny's lab, so we didn't get there yet. I'm still in Andre's lab.
But we're getting to next. Yeah, we're Andre's with the growth hormone.
So Andre had the mutation, the Ames dwarf, that led to multiple hormone deficiencies.
Right.
And then he also had the growth hormone receptor knockout mouse, which was a very clean model and was the oldest mouse known to man.
Right.
And this is the mouse that he received the Methuselah Mouse Prize for.
Yeah.
So, and I was actually in the lab when we discovered that, or when we saw that mouse live to that old age of a week or two short of 5 years.
Now, when I spoke to him about this in Santa Barbara a few months ago, he also made the point that the mouse was being extremely well looked after, and that might have contributed to its longevity as well.
True, but again, the controls of the wild-type animals are also being extremely well looked after. So everybody's receiving the same conditions.
Right.
The only difference is there's a mutation that leads to a smaller body size and an extended life.
Right.
Conditions, they're even in the same cage together.
All right, so having gone through this 2 days of, oh my God, what did you then take from it? What did you then come to realize? What was your sense at that point?
I was reading a review by Cynthia Kenyon, and this was in Cell. And she had spoke of this dilemma. And she had said, well, it looks like these Ames dwarf mutants are a CR mimetic, or that they have the same phenotype as CR. But there's a paradox, because based on their insulin sensitivity, et cetera, technically they shouldn't have received a benefit, a further benefit in life extension. So more work needs to be done.
Right.
And at that time, I was just compilating my data from the growth hormone receptor knockout mouse and the interaction studies with CR. So I had just walked into Andre's office. I sat down and I said, you're going to think I'm crazy, but I think that everybody's right. And what I meant was the people that were in opposition of his long-lived mutant. And I said, I think that maybe this model is just a little cleaner, a little easier to understand, because when we put it on CR, it doesn't receive a benefit. And at least not in most of the animals. There was a small numerical increase at the end of life for females only. Mm-hmm. But when doing an overall analysis, it was very clear that they did not receive the benefit of CR that their wild type controls did. So I had realized, wow, this is definitely a fit for concepts like Tom Kirkwood's and disposable soma,
right,
where there's trade-offs between reproduction and lifespan. And you just brought this up, of course, in Linda's paper. At this time, also, sirtuins were exploding. And if anybody's seen Lenny or David's talks, you'll see that every year there's more and more publications about sirtuins. Well, we were back at the point where sirtuins were very exciting in yeast and worms and flies, but we didn't know a lot about what was going on in mammals.
Right.
And there was a whole animal SIRT1 knockout developed by McBurney, and this animal was smaller and had altered pituitary size, and it was definitely an altered pituitary in response to knocking out SIRT1 globally in the body. But what he found was that these animals eventually got sick. So I went into Andre's office and I said, Andre, or at this time, Dr. Parkey, you won't believe it, but when you knock out SIRT1, the pituitary gets messed up, or something's going on where it changes the structure and the hormone signaling coming from the pituitary. And he looks at me and he goes, but they die young. And I said, yes, but maybe knocking it out in the whole body isn't a good thing, especially since in the worms, flies, and yeast, it was very clear that overexpressing it was the benefit on longevity. Mm-hmm. So in mammals, we kind of hit a brick wall for a moment, or at least I thought the sirtuin field hit a brick wall for a moment, because they had a SIRT1 knockout mouse that was short-lived. That kind of fit the story. But their transgenic mouse, or their mouse that overexpressed SIRT1, it was understood in the pipeline, it wasn't yet published, that this animal wasn't receiving a benefit in lifespan. And that wasn't expected, because in the worms, flies, and yeast, when you overexpress SIRT1, you saw an extension in lifespan.
Right.
When they got to mammals, they hit a brick wall. So I approached Lenny and I told him I would really like to work for you, or I work on this project. And he was very much in support. This was like a year and a half before I had acquired my PhD. And he was like, no, come now, give a talk. I want to hear what you got to say, and blah, blah, blah. So I went to MIT, I gave my talk, and then I kind of threw this idea out there. And he was skeptical, and he should be. I mean, you know, I'm a PhD student at this time. I don't even have my doctorate. And I did acquire some publications, but still I'm a student. So when I got to his lab, I went after the pituitary. And I decided, let's knock out SIRT1 specifically in the pituitary. Because, again, if knocking it out globally wasn't good, which was expected, maybe just altering it in the pituitary would have something to do with the homeostatic mechanism of balance. Whereas in, since the whole animal knockout did have reduced hormone features, maybe knocking out the pituitary would just target the hormone axes.
Otherwise, the global thing was masking something.
Exactly. Yeah. So meanwhile, not even altering the peripheral levels or the other tissues, the somatic tissues, levels of SIRT1. So first, Lenny said to me, well, if this story is going to make any sense, you're going to have to tell me what happens to SIRT1 in the pituitary under calorie restriction.
Right.
Because everywhere that we've looked, except for maybe the liver, we see that under calorie restriction, there's an increase in SIRT1. So your justification for knocking it out doesn't make sense to me. So I went ahead and I looked in a large group of animals at the levels of SIRT1 after 6 months of chronic calorie restriction at about 30% reduction in calories. And what I saw was a robust decrease in SIRT1 in the pituitary. So sure enough, we started making the mouse, and our phenotype actually came to be what's being presented here at this meeting. If you'd like, I can go into it now, or...
No, just, yeah.
Okay, so when I knocked it out in the pituitary, it was exactly what I had predicted, which was almost too good to be true. Essentially, the hormone axes were altered, in the same way that calorie restriction alters the hormone axis. Right. There was a reduction in growth hormone, IGF-1, in the periphery, which was a marker of this reduction in growth hormone, or the somatotropic axis, which is the growth hormone signaling axis. And there was a robust decrease in fecundity. I could see the animal was had it seemed to have smaller like testes. I saw, like, it didn't look reproductively fit to me. So I began to characterize its reproductive fertility, and I saw reductions in the hormones from the pituitary. I saw reductions in sperm count, and I definitely saw reduced fertility. In fact, almost infertile. So I went back to CR. First, I went to the literature, and I said, what does CR say about fecundity? Like, what is the actual data? And it's actually very sparse when it comes to mouse and rats and males as far as sperm counts and their number of offspring and et cetera from the male side. There's more done in the female. But knowing that the male was a simpler beast, I just looked at male CR, and what I saw was exactly what I saw in the Pitsko mouse, a reduction in sperm count and a reduction in the pituitary hormones that drive reproduction. So that's when I had to now go sit in Lenny's office and say, Lenny, this is going to sound crazy, but I think that SIRT1, when it got to the mammal, needed more homeostatic balance. Essentially, as we're more complex, there's more chances that we can handle diverse situations. So by having SIRT1 have different functions in different tissues, maybe that's an evolutionarily conserved mechanism to protect us so that we can ensure that our genetics are propagated and that we live long enough to propagate our genetics. Mm-hmm. So he's like, you know, I'm not sure, what do you mean? And I said, well, it's very simple. If under calorie restriction, SIRT1 goes down in the pituitary, this suppresses the hormone axis. If it's suppressing the hormone axis because food is not available, and the last thing you'd want to do is bring a child into a world where you don't have the food to feed it. So during this time of calorie restriction, the hormone axes are down, very similar to an Ames dwarf or a Snell dwarf mouse, which is smaller and has the reproductive changes. At the same time, growth is down. You don't have the energy to put into growth. So let's take this energy and let's shift it to maintenance of the soma. Let's make sure our tissues and our DNA have the fidelity and have the stringency to be able to be around for when food is available. Mm-hmm. And this actually fit the model perfect, where when we look at CR, we see an increase in peripheral activity of SIRT1 go up, and we see a decrease in the central or the hypothalamic pituitary hormonal axis go down.
That's right. Well, this goes back, I mean, some very early papers by George Williams on pleiotropy and so on, which you will have discovered recently.
Yes. I mean, I remember reading about, I think it was 1957 that he, that was the day that quote was, or that theory was put together. But that things that make you stronger and bigger and more fit for reproduction or more fit may not be good for a long lifespan.
And the reason I think that you'll find that it was more evident in females, certainly in female human beings, I'll give you a clear example. The age of, as people eat more and eat more and eat more, there's diets, the age of menarche has gone down in girls simply because they have more energy available because they're eating much more, probably too much. And so their ability to reproduce, or the conditions which will allow them to reproduce, the age of menarche has gone down. Because it's this homeostatic energy balance shifting again.
It's a perfect example. And of course, in anorexia, we know that pregnancy is not an option. It won't happen. But in obesity, you do have women that still have babies and still go through the whole gestation period, right, even though they're obese. So that also is supportive.
But you start thinking about that in terms of, obviously, in terms of males, as you made the point. So it wasn't sticking out in quite the same way. So this is kind of a nice, interesting detective story that you went on there. And did you say that you began as Angie's lab manager?
Yeah.
So were you actually working at a job, or was that part of your graduate work as well?
So I was doing my master's in a reproductive physiology lab under Dr. Todd Winters. And he is now the department chair in the agriculture at Southern Illinois University. And we had done a lot of animal surgeries, and we had looked at the effects of hormones in response to soy isoflavones. which one of these polyphenol compounds was actually resveratrol at the time. But we were more focused on daisine and glycine and these other isoflavones that we call them, that were high in soy. They're also high in legumes. Maybe you're familiar with the issues in Australia where they were eating the red clover, and this led to infertility.
Right.
Back maybe 20 years, 30 years ago, and they kept having problems with the sheep, and they finally figured out that there was a constituent in the red clover that led to that animal's infertility. So I was doing this in pigs.
Right.
And I was, and Andre was collaborating with my professor. So I had known him, and I had known that he was a great, great man with many, many attributes to the scientific field. So as my master's professor's money was running lower, I'd realized maybe it's time for me to move on. And he would never say it's time for you to go because we had a great relationship. But I was like, well, what about Andre Barkey? And he's like, well, if you can get in, go ahead. And I thought to myself, Dr. Barkey is Polish. I was like, I got to go ask him for a job. So I put a tie on. I went and sat down in his office and I said, Dr. Barkey, Todd Winters said that you really took care of him when he came to this university as a PI, as a faculty member. And Dr. Winters says I'm one of his best students and he's sending me here for a job with you. And he gave me the job, and within like 2 or 3 months, he was making the transition to the sister campus at SIU School of Medicine in Springfield, Illinois. And he took me and my wife hiking, and he said, you know, are you sure you want to go to Chicago and do your PhD? Why don't you come with me? Mm-hmm. And that's what led to all of that.
That's very interesting. How did you get into science in the first place? I mean, what was it? Was it just always a passion, or?
No, I mean, honestly, if my science high school teachers knew now, I think they would definitely fall back in their chair. But I think it was when I had just begun going to the community college. I didn't return to school till I was maybe 21 or 22. I was in restaurant management, and I was also worked a lot in pet stores. And I kind of thought in the back of my head, I want to be a vet. I want to work with animals. And I went to community college and I started taking biochemistry and all these things, and I realized, wow, like, this is great. And now that I was a little bit older, I was much more serious because I didn't want to go back and work at the restaurant till 4 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And I didn't want to have to close the pet shop and, you know, clean the dog kennel cages. So I was like, you know, this is great. And so I applied to U of I and their College of Agriculture and Animal Sciences with hope of being a vet. I think they quote that, a vet hopeful. I didn't get into vet school, but I did already do research with professors because I had volunteered just to get exposure. And when I didn't get in, they said, oh no, please go get your master's. And I said, but with who? And they said, well, Todd Winters and Carbondale, and that's where that went.
So I'm sorry, the reason I was laughing there was that I was making this possibly spurious connection between restaurant and pet shop, and here you are doing calorie restriction with animals in it.
Yeah, I do. I do find it's a bit ironic at times, but what I actually am surprised is so many times along my career I've thought to myself, well, I didn't have this same education that this person had, or, you know, I don't have the straight A GPA that this person has. But what I realized was that my background and exposure had given me a different perspective. And I had thought of it when I was doing my PhD with Andre, but I also thought to myself, maybe I'm hiding under Andre's wing, and that really, I don't have what it would really take to make a difference if I stood out further on my own. And I think that's why they make, or they have a postdoc system, is so that you can prove you can do it again. And when I got to MIT, I was very intimidated. I was corn-fed, Midwest. I was thinking to myself, here, you know, I'm gonna go swim with the sharks. And Andre had great confidence that I would do just fine. 2 or 3 months later, it was home to me.
Yeah. Lenny, of course, is a great mentor as well. So.
Excellent, excellent. I mean, and very different. He's taught me so much. Andre was more like my father. Lenny's kind of more like whipping me into shape as far as this is what needs to be done and this is how we do it. Yeah. You know.
There's an interesting point here, which is that some of what you're finding there is kind of rediscovery in some sense. I mentioned the George Williams thing, and this makes a larger point about that I often make, as you know, about the way in which different disciplines go along their certain paths, and there's all this massive information over here, which is actually relevant if they knew the literature as well. It's so hard when science has become so fragmented into different silos, and when so much of it is systems-wide.
And then it's even worse when people take a personal attachment and they say, wait, my theory must be correct because I have this data. And somebody else who's working their butt off says, wait, my theory must be correct. And when I had to walk into Lenny's office and say, listen, I think there's a whole bunch of theories that are correct and they all apply here and they apply to the evolutionary conservancy of CERTI-1. It makes sense. We say disposable soma by Tom Kirkwood. Right. There's an allocation of energy resources. But once you switch to repro, now it's antagonistic pleiotropy, of course, that we just discussed. At the same time, free radical stress theory or oxidative stress are still withheld because during that time of energy conservation and maintenance of the tissues, we need to protect against free radical stress if that's damaging and causing aging. We need to protect against DNA damage if that's damaging and that's causing aging. So it's kind of an encompassing theory where it says, listen, everybody that's been working so hard is really doing a good job. We just have to figure out how to put it all together and make it one coherent story. So I wouldn't dare say that CERTI-1 is on top and regulating everything, but an energy-dependent protein that's conserved across, evolutionarily conserved, must be important. It just would make no sense to me if it wasn't. It's a protein that's expressed everywhere in the body. And then when we get to mammals, we see 7 different ones. Some are in the nucleus, some are in the cytosol, some are in the mitochondria. To think that they didn't play a role in interpreting energy signals to the body and telling the body what to do and when to do it is ludicrous. It would just make clear sense that an energy-dependent protein would respond, for example, to dietary restriction or to overfeeding, as we see with David Sinclair's work.
So I think it's clearly crucial that this kind of information get out there. So many magazine covers these days are about the aging cure or about diet. There's metabolic syndrome. There's a lot of very serious concern about people's diet. On the way here in the airport, I picked up this book by Michael Pollan, who of course wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, is a well-known writer on food issues. This has got a series of food rules in here, simple nostrums that you can follow, and so on. Do you have some sort of a passion about getting this information out to a general audience as well?
I do so much. I mean, one of the things that I noticed is that this information sitting here and this information sitting here, and I'll mention to these two different PI, did you realize that this may be because of this? And they'll look at me like I had some profound discovery. I'll be like, you guys presented this and taught me what you've done. And all I did was just read what you wrote, and it seems that it's sitting right there and it's a coherent story. Did you explore it? Yeah. And that, so yes, as a general audience goes, it's definitely important because as we see that energy balance or food alters your lifespan, it's important that we take this into consideration. When we see these old mice on calorie restriction at an advanced age, and I've done these studies myself in excess of 4 years for a CR mouse. It's so reassuring that what you're doing is important because the ad libitum animal, or the animal under unlimited food, has kyphosis or curvature of the spine. The hair looks bad. They're shaking when they lift to get the food, similar to what we would see in an advanced age human. When you look at that brother and sister or that litter mate on a 30% CR diet, its fur is silky, it's happy, and when I say it's happy, it's doing backflips practically, it's climbing, it's doing all these wonderful things where that ad libitum mouse at the same age is shaking, is not handling it so well. So that must be important. And if it applies to humans, I hope. But at this point, I'm not that concerned with it applying to humans as a whole now. I first want to understand, why does it change a rodent's life? And if I can understand why, then maybe I can understand how to apply it to humans. Now, I definitely would not advocate that it doesn't apply to humans in any way. But I wouldn't also sit here and say, like, well, because I found this in a mouse, this means humans should do this. That would not be. That would be too grandiose. I think that because I found it in a mouse, let's figure out why. And it may just as well apply to other mammals, like humans. And I think we see that it is pretty pleiotropic in its effects.
So,
at least across species.
I had a conversation earlier in the week with Melanie Samuel, who's a second year postdoc and so on. There was some concern, which I want to find out if you share it. I assume that your ambition at this point would be, okay, this is great. I love what I'm doing. This is fun. I want my own lab one day, as does she. And despite the very positive governmental sense of science at this point, restoring science to its rightful place and so on from President Obama, resources seem to be pretty tight at this point.
They are very tight. It's funny, as you say that, I find myself constantly challenged to maintain just my funding as a postdoctoral candidate, and, you know, of course, looking for a fellowship, relying on the National Institute of Health to get it, and the money is very, very scarce right now. I don't know what that effect has from an evolutionary standpoint on my longevity, but it's definitely challenging. But I do have inspiration, and that inspiration is just keep, it's like, it's either my grandfather or Andre Barkey, and maybe it's a little bit of both of what they taught me. And my grandfather always said that never chase the dollar, just do what you're good at, enjoy it, and it'll find you. Mm-hmm. And Andre Barkey once told me, when you're good, you never have a problem finding a job. Now, I know that's a bit, you know, like pretentious. I don't mean it to sound pretentious, but what I mean is I think those two together mean a lot. Mm-hmm. Keep working, do the best you can, and somebody will recognize and somebody will offer that position. But my understanding is it's like, I wouldn't quote me as far as the statistics go, but it's like there's 100 qualified applicants for every faculty position open right now that opens. That's very challenging. It may be much worse, but I do understand that I've heard that at least by word of mouth many times. And that's a bit daunting when it comes to I may be interviewing very shortly. Of course, I have more work to do, but the option's coming.
Yeah. But you ever consider doing anything else, or is science it for you? I mean, that's now.
Many times, especially when experiments aren't working. But no, you know, there's one thing I remembered. Again, going back to what, when Andre brought me to a meeting, he had brought me to a request for RFA. And he had asked, he said, he had asked me, you know, would you like to come? There's not going to be any other students. There are not going to be any other postdocs. It's just going to be PIs. I'm like, oh, I'd be honored. So I went to the meeting with them, and I was at dinner with 20 greats. And these were great names. I remember at the time, I think like Steven Spindler was there. There's just really, really important figures in calorie restriction and aging. So I had asked everybody at the dinner table, I was kind of a little bit, maybe too pushy, but I asked. I said, how many times in the last year have you not wanted to go to work? The room fell silent. And then somebody made a joke and said, well, does it count if I didn't want to go in until after lunch? That to me just said it right there. It's like, it doesn't matter what you're getting paid or whatever. If you can do something you love, why would you stop it? Whether it's a hobby or if your hobby is actually what you love to do and you call it your job. And I've so many times heard scientists say, I'm surprised they even pay us to do what we do. In other words, being so grateful that they get to follow their passion. So for me, I'm going to stay with that. I'm going to stay with that concept, and I'm just going to keep working. And hopefully either after 100 interviews, maybe I'll finally find that job, or maybe I'll get approached. I don't know. But I do know that what we're doing now is making a difference, and it's happening pretty quickly. We saw Sirtris blow up. We've seen the application of these compounds that affect these proteins that we think are involved in aging, or that there's much evidence that shows is involved in aging. And we see these compounds being applied for human disease now. They're going through the trials now. So it's happening right in front of us. It's no longer a dream, and it's no longer the concept of snake oil merchants and these crazy people that want to study aging. When society realized that aging encompasses so many different diseases, or that so many diseases occur or have an increase of occurrence with age, aging became more important. And it was a pivotal thing for us as aging researchers. The science was respected when the genetics got hardcore. When the genetics really, when we started using those genetic tools and we really started showing that the genetics of aging is important and genes can affect your lifespan, that's when we started getting, or when we were really taken seriously. But, you know, as a whole, the National Institute of Aging receives less as a whole than, say, you know, the National Cancer Institute or et cetera. But what I always find so interesting is that when we do calorie restriction, we don't affect one disease. We affect a plethora of diseases. Mm. We reduce cancer incidence. We reduce all these different instances. And even at end-of-life pathology, where that little mouse lived even longer, there's still less cancer. So the chances of it having cancer at an advanced age was even greater because it was around longer for that to occur. And it still had a decreased chance of or incidence of neoplastic growth or a decreased onset of cancer. So to me, that's so important.
I remember hearing somewhere, I think I'm right in quoting this, that of the costs that Medicare went into, I think it was 27% the expenditure was on metabolic syndrome problems, and 24% was in the last year of life. That could have been 24 and 27, I'm not sure which, but that's over 50% in those two things, both of which you just said are amenable enormously to number of things like calorie restriction and so on and so forth. So it obviously makes sense. It makes economic sense to do it.
And very much so. And many times I've had people stop me and go, but I don't understand, Michael. Why do you want to make people live even longer? Like, the advanced age individual ends up in a retirement home, has to be taken care of. Why would you want to do that even longer? But that's not what we're trying to do. Right. What we're trying to do is increase your health span, so that you don't go into that home or you don't need that assistance until a later age. So we're not just trying to increase lifespan, we're trying to increase the health span or the healthiness of the individual with time. And that's what makes it so exciting when we see it happen in a mammal, in a mouse, that yes, this may be able to happen in a human. And this would have a huge impact economically, socially, and of course, just peace of mind. To be able to reduce many diseases at once with one simple intervention is very exciting.
Well, Michael Bankowski, I wish you well in following your passion.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.